Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Jared Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, it's been a weird week. We've had Labor Day, the Jewish holidays. I feel like I haven't even gotten started, and it's almost the weekend already.
And it's almost the weekend, exactly. Well, we're going to pack a lot in this show and in the next 2 days before the weekend, because stuff is happening. Notably, we've got the 20th anniversary of 9/11 upon us, and we're going to get to learn about a very little-known story of how a group of Hollywood creatives came together after 9/11 to help the government game out possible terrorist attacks. This is the Now It Can Be Told. The Wrap's Ben Svetke will join us to talk about this secret meeting that has been barely discussed until now.
Then Hollywood mourned the passing of Michael Kenneth Williams, the former star of The Wire and Lovecraft Country, who died this week at the age of 54. He left a mark on the industry that far outweighed his stardom, and we'll discuss his legacy with The Ringer's Van Lathan and Ernest Jones, editor-at-large of Philadelphia Magazine. But first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines. And is it RIP for Time's Up? Eva Longoria, Shonda Rhimes, and Journey Smollett were among the board members who announced over the holiday weekend that they were stepping down from their positions at the embattled group. It follows quickly on the heels of the resignations last month of board chairwoman Roberta Kaplan and CEO Tina Chen. Four current board members are staying on board to help transition the nonprofit into its next iteration. Sharon, let me ask, do you have any faith in what I guess will be Time's Up 2.0?
No, not a lot, actually. I wrote a piece that was pretty disappointed and fairly definitive this week that in which I said, you know, this is the end of Time's Up as we know it. The whole idea of Time's Up was to the bringing together of powerful women who would use their power to change the power structure itself on behalf of other women who do not have the advantages and privilege that they had earned in their lives and careers. People like Shonda Rhimes, people like Eva Longoria, Journey Smollett, who you mentioned, in addition to them, Hillary Rosen, a major political operative, Nina Shaw, a powerful entertainment lawyer, and many other people like that. They, as a group, resigned en masse over the Labor Day weekend. And it was a sad end, but the fact that they all decided to resign was really meant that this idea that was the motivating idea behind Time's Up, that powerful women could use their power from the top down to change systemic inequity and systemic predators, predation, or sexual assault in the workplace was something that they could impact. The fact that they've all resigned is a clear sign that they believe that they have hit a wall. And a lot of it is the stuff that we've documented on The Wrap in great detail, the resignation of a first CEO, the kind of conflict of interest and the appearance of conflict of interest for Roberta Kaplan and Tina Chen, who are important women in the Democratic landscape, who were advising Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, who also has now resigned over sexual misconduct accusations. So it's really tricky, as the piece that I wrote suggested. There's a discussion internally, some kind of tension over whether Time's Up should be focused on changing policy or focused on helping survivors, and that the younger staff members felt that they should really be focused on every survivor, and that the board felt that they really should be focused on policy and how to move the needle for all of society. I happen to agree with the board, but I don't know that that is a reason for the entire board to resign. In my opinion, it had more to do with the fact that they couldn't find a CEO who would stick, that they were taking hit after hit in the headlines over scandals that were larger or smaller, but just negative headlines. and they didn't need it. You know, all of these women have very important day jobs, and Time's Up doesn't pay them. In fact, Shonda Rhimes and Katie McGrath, the producer, are people who have largely funded Time's Up. So whatever it becomes, it will not be this concept that it started as.
Yeah, you use the phrase they wanted to tackle this from the top down, and it seems like that's where they got muddled, was that in that top area, and they got a little too close to the other people at the top. Instead of using their influence, they kind of sidled up to people, and it just gave, you know, as you said, the wrong feeling to people who thought they should have been getting into the weeds a little bit more and getting, you know, with specific people and specific survivors as opposed to this grand plan. And I agree with you that in theory that makes sense, right? Like the average person isn't going to get access to the CEOs of the biggest companies. Shonda Rhimes can. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, Time's Up as a group mm-hmm. could mm-hmm. get access to these big people in order to make big sweeping changes, but it just didn't come together that way. And
well, it's not even that. I think what came to be, what became clear was that when you get in bed with these big corporations or big political figures, you run the risk of being tainted when they are accused of something. Part of the problem for Time's Up is that they had this new idea of running a for-profit business, even though they're fundamentally a nonprofit, to advise companies on cutting-edge harassment policies or anti-harassment policies. And that's what sort of came back and bit Tina Chen and Roberta Kaplan on the ass, frankly, because they were working with Cuomo on legislation around that. And then they got were asked for their advice around these sexual misconduct allegations that arose. The reality is the real world is messy. If you're going to try to change it, some of the stink may end up sticking to you. And I think that is the question we need to think about. Is there zero tolerance, zero acceptance of getting smudged, you know, getting some of the dirt on you when you're involved in issues like systemic change? Or is absolute purity, remain a nonprofit, make sure you're, you know, everything is happening, every conversation is being recorded, everything is being done with full transparency? I mean, in principle, we all would want that. But in reality, when you're trying to negotiate change, when you're trying to get people to give up something that they had before, I suspect it requires some messiness. If you think back to how Lyndon Johnson got the Civil Rights Act passed and things like that, and again, I am not here defending or not defending the actions of Tina Chen and Roberta Kaplan. I am just here regretting and heartbroken that this very powerful idea with these powerful women has gone away. But to go back to Lyndon Johnson, if you read Robert Caro's history, it's very clear that Lyndon Johnson did a lot of moving and maneuvering and white lies. And, you know, he did what politicians do, but he got a massive amount, a huge historic amount of civil rights legislation passed when no one thought that was possible. So I just think it's important to bear in mind that when there is a movement now for a certain amount of absolute purity, that probably isn't realistic when we're trying to achieve change.
No, I'd agree. I think it's impractical to expect perfection, even from people who are striving to bring good. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. That's my thought. Oh, it's on me. Sorry. Moving along. Our next topic is Britney Spears. The Britney Spears conservatorship took another big step towards ending this week when her father filed papers that would finally bring that to an end after 13 years. In this filing, Jamie Spears said that Britney is, quote, entitled to have this court now seriously consider whether this conservatorship is no longer required, to which many of us say, about time. Jamie has been the poster child for everything that's wrong with the conservatorship, and he is clearly trying to save face here as Britney's attorney claimed that he leaked the filing to the press before it was even served to her legal team. Daniel, you did predict this, but do you seem like we are reaching the end of the conservatorship road?
I think we're reaching the end of half of it, right? We've explained this before. She is right. Under two different kinds of conservatorships, one that's business and finance oriented, which is what Jamie is involved in. He is the head of that. And one, which is a conservatorship over the person, which is when you get into medical, personal needs, things like that. And that's the one that still would probably need to be unwind. Jamie, he's trying to extricate himself easily, which is not going to happen easily, and try and save some face because he has been, much maligned over the years. But it's going to be very interesting because we still have Jody Montgomery, who is the conservator over her person. And that's the one that's way more complicated. And I think the one that's very tricky because people don't like to talk about it, but Brittany has issues. And there's a reason why this has been in place for as long as it is. Is it a good thing? Probably not. Is it somewhat needed? I would imagine so. So we'll see what Jody eventually files in the coming days. There's a hearing, I think, in 3 weeks that will, start to unravel some of this. But it's definitely a good step in the right direction. But I think it's the easiest step so far. The harder one, I think, is still to come.
Well, I think most of us are thinking, why did it take so long? the guy, I mean, obviously the answer was money, right? That he was able to make a pretty good living taking a commission for his work as her conservator. And that was really distasteful to a lot of people, considering Brittany kept saying she wanted basically anybody but him in charge of her affairs.
Yeah, I think it's good she finally was able to use her voice and speak out, and she deserves the right to make her own decisions now, whether they be good or bad.
I think she's
reached that point.
Yeah.
All right, finally this week, the Toronto Film Festival is starting, and it figures to be a very interesting year for the fest. The lineup features 200 films, as opposed to last year's COVID/lineup of just 50. But a lot of the biggest titles have already been snatched up. Demand is at an all-time high. The endless number of streaming options will do that. Mm-hmm. And the Delta variant still looms over the industry as a whole. Sharon, I know you love this time of year. What do you make of this year's festival?
Well, I mean, I think it's great that the festival is back, at least partially in person. I'm not there this year, but Steve Pond, our awards editor, is. We're doing this weird sort of hybrid covering it from here, covering some of it in person. We're having our studio, which we do every year, and kicking off this week and really getting going this weekend, in which we bring in a lot of the cast. Some of that's happening in real life in Toronto. Some of that's happening virtually based here. So this is, necessity is the mother of invention, and we figured that out. We really, I've missed going to getting to sit in a theater and watch basically 5 movies a day, which you can do, but now virtually it's more complicated. There's a lot of films. There's one, for example, that is for sale. I talked to the writer, directors, and the star, Sigourney Weaver, today. So that's just one example of a movie that is for sale, that is more in the mode of the kinds of films that there's room for now that there are streamers. It's a film in which it's based on a novel. Sigourney Weaver plays a woman her own age in her 60s who's just trying to live her life and make her own choices and maybe drinks a little bit too much from time to time, fools around with Kevin Klein, which is super fun. But it's this sort of New England town where all of this is going on. But it's essentially a character study of a woman she's just in sort of I would say the prime of her life, but that's not the kind of movie you're going to see in theaters when you've got James Bond and Mission Impossible and all these other aircraft carriers lined up to take off and maybe aborted takeoff, actually, for a lot of them. Aircraft carriers don't take off, Sharon. I mean, you really ought to know that they're in the water and the planes are on the aircraft carrier. So please don't at me in your tweets about this. I know that. Really being able to have room in the marketplace for those kinds of films, the films that we love seeing at film festivals, Scenes from a Marriage, which is not a film, but a series, like a limited series, which is a remake of a 1960s European film. This with Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac was just in Venice. These are, these are like character-based, they're human scale. And at the same time, there's some of these very big films like Dune that's coming up, which is a massive production by Denis Villeneuve, with big monsters and spacecraft and witchcraft and such.
And Timothy
Chalamet. So it's great to see, and we'll see what's going to start winning some of the festivals. But the fact that a lot of titles sold before the festival is not a bad thing. It's a sign of health in the market. So that actually is really good.
Yeah, I wonder what that's going to do going forward. You know, it just seems like with the demand high and things just, you know, there's so many different places to go. I wonder for all festivals going forward, if we're going to have those big, like, oh my God, this just sold type headlines, because you're going to see so many of these deals
in advance.
Do you think this trend will continue?
It really depends, because the strategy used to be for a festival like a Sundance, which is very much mostly films that have not been sold, right? Unlike Toronto. Toronto is much more of a mix. Lots and lots of films go there with distribution, and it's just like a platform for them to shine ahead of award season or ahead of the fall. But at Sundance, it's really films that don't have distribution by new filmmakers that people haven't discovered yet. And there the strategy is usually you want a bidding war. So you wait and you don't show it until Sundance. I think the pressure of all of the competition that streamers have to get the best movies the first, you know, fastest, in addition to them making all of these deals with talent up front, you know, Netflix, Amazon, Peacock, Viacom, they all have done that. But these new films, it'll be really interesting to see if that kind of bidding war strategy that used to be definitely the way you wanted to go, whether that still holds, because somebody will come in and Apple will plunk down such a big number in advance, sight unseen, maybe, who knows, that you just can't say no. It's, you know, it's a buyer's, it's a seller's market for sure.
Oh yeah, for sure. All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and something she's a little more upset about, riled up about, angry about, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Why, thank you, Daniel. Well, this week I'm going to focus on something good, something that feels like progress, which is President Biden has just mandated vaccines for companies that have 100 employees or more, and vaccines or weekly COVID tests for people who work for the federal government. I think all I can say is, President Biden, it's about friggin' time. It's about time. We are not getting out of this pandemic. This thing keeps grinding on and on. The naysayers, the people who are misinformed about the dangers of the very low dangers of the COVID vaccine, those folks who are either themselves getting sick and dying. We had four conservative radio talk show hosts, incredibly, getting sick and dying of COVID, and still people are not flocking to get vaccinated. It is going to require this kind of mandating. And, you know, I think that we're moving in that direction in California. I got to be in New York for the first time in a year and a half, a week or so ago, and every restaurant required proof of vaccination. I was like, rock on. That is exactly what I want for me to feel safe in this restaurant. And that has to be true, should be true for schools and for campuses. Schools, obviously, I believe that California is about to mandate, I saw a story on this yesterday, is going to mandate vaccines in schools for all attendees who are of age, meaning up to age from 12 onward. And great, like, let's solve this problem. You know, we are going to have to figure out a way to deal with this. I think that Biden has been afraid in the wake of the turmoil and the chaos and the trauma of the Trump years to force anything on anyone. He just wanted to do it by consensus. But he has the bully pulpit. He has the power of the executive order. And we are being held hostage as a nation by a minority that is either skeptical or actively delusional. And at this point, thank God that Biden is ready to take the hit, be the bad guy. So it's always the reputation of Democrats that they're just too soft to actually play hardball. When it comes to this, we need a leader who's willing to play some hardball. So I'm glad that we're moving toward vaccine mandates. That's my wax on and my wax off.
Yeah, I think the idea that the vaccine is a personal decision is what is screwing this up. It's not. It is a decision you make for the greater good of all of us. And so if you don't get it, you don't get to play with the other children. Plain and simple. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
All right, that does it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we'll discuss the Secret Hollywood Project in the days after 9/11 and the legacy of the Wire star, Michael K. Williams. Stick around.
In the days following the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, the U.S. government turned to Hollywood for help. What followed was a secret meeting that included some of the biggest creative names in town, where they gamed out what follow-up attacks on our country might look like. The details of this have never been reported until now. We've invited Ben Svetky, who's newly joined The Wrap as a consulting editor, to talk about what he found in this fascinating story. Welcome to you, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, when you mentioned to me as we were talking about the anniversary upcoming that this meeting had happened between the likes of Pentagon officials and Oliver Stone and David Milius and people like that, I really thought you were smoking something. But this is true. Like, what happened?
Well, I probably was smoking something, but it also happens to be true.
Well, sorry, I didn't mean to rat you out there. Okay.
What happened was about a couple of weeks after the November 11th attacks, a major general in the Pentagon came up with the idea of bringing together some Hollywood creative people and having them just sort of game out some of the most extreme, weird, possible terrorist attacks they could think of. I mean, you got to remember that back then, nobody could have predicted what had happened on 9/11. The idea of turning jetliners into torpedoes and aiming them at buildings, nobody had thought of that. So at that point, people were like, what next? Anything was possible. So the Pentagon turned to Hollywood, which specializes in anything being possible, and asked them to get together secretly in Marina Del Rey to spend a night thinking about these things and coming up with various scenarios. They ended up coming up with so many deadly concepts that they had to go another night. A couple of weeks later, they made again to continue the process. And all of these scenarios were put in a report that went all the way up to the White House.
So let's just talk about, you sent me the list of names. I've gotten a peek at the story that's going to be published tomorrow, or maybe it's up on the site, but it was people like David Fincher, Spike Jones of Being John Malkovich fame, which seems completely crazy to me, Mary Lambert, Dick Wolf, who does all the Law and Order series, David Ayer, who did Training Day, Martha Coolidge, who doesn't seem like somebody who'd come up with disaster scenarios.
She was Naomi, a Directors Guild president or something.
I see. Okay. John Landau, the producer of Avatar. This is not all of them. David Milch, who, of course, wrote Hill Street Blues and many other series. Yeah. And Oliver Stone, our conspiracy theorist in chief, among many others. Was this an act of desperation or an act of like incredible out of the box thinking?
Maybe a little bit of both. I think, you know, remember, as I'm sure you remember, that people were sort of gripped with fear at that point and were so astonished by what had happened that I think they were open to hearing whatever other possibilities could be out there. They were, you know, you also have to remember that the Bush administration's relationship with Hollywood was not very cozy at that point.
Right, that's right.
So this was a bit of a leap for them to approach Hollywood for their help. But they had in place an organization called the Institute of Creative Technology, which was an Army research lab entity that worked with USC that had spent a couple of years before 9/11 doing sort of really high-tech war gaming and virtual reality, training and weapons
for movies or for the military?
No, for the military. This is for the military. Mm-hmm. But they had used a couple of military people. You mentioned John Milius. He had been a consultant, apparently, even before 9/11. So then when 9/11 happened and this major general, A. Michael Andrews, came up with this idea, they had an entity in place that they could go to and say, we know you guys are in touch with Hollywood. Can you put this together? And they called it the Entertainment Industry Task Force, although that, you know, it was a secret name, but that was what they called it. And according to Andrews, virtually everybody who was asked to join, joined. People were very enthusiastic about doing this. A, because people were feeling particularly patriotic, even in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And B, it sounded super cool. I mean, like, if you were a creative, wouldn't you want to, you know, and made action movies or whatever kind of movies, hanging out with the army to talk about potential terrorist plots sounds like kind of a fun way to spend the night in a weird way.
And so, do you know, was this useful at all? Do you know, like, what were these scenarios at all? Or do you know what the scenarios were? Did we found that out?
Those scenarios are still secret because just unleashing of, there was a huge, you know, a big binder of these ideas. One of the people in attendance who worked for the military said it was like going to a writer's room. You know, they would just sort of throw out ideas and he would write them down and compile this big book of ideas, which is what they brought to the White House. Hmm. They met with, I'm trying to remember his name, Wayne Downing, who was at that time Deputy National Security Advisor in charge of combating terrorism. And he had an office in the White House, and they met with him there. And apparently he didn't say a word throughout the entire briefing. Then took the briefing book, and nobody who was involved in this project has any idea what happened to it then, except one of our sources has said that he suspects he's seen some of these terrorist potential plots subsequently appear in movies.
Really?
Yeah, which is kind of interesting.
So we don't really know if it helped.
We don't. I don't even think the people who are involved with it know whether it helped. You know, it did no harm. It was good for the military to sort of go outside the box and think in ways that they hadn't before. And who knows? We don't know. It may very well have ended up saving some lives. We just don't know what Dick Wolf or Oliver Stone came up with that could have been a potential disaster.
Daniel?
I was going to say, from what, not to make light of this weird situation, but if, as you imagine this room of people and you've read off some of the names that were involved, who do you think was probably like the leader of the room? Who do you imagine was the one who was most outspoken, coming up with ideas and whatnot? Have you thought about
that? That's a pretty fascinating question. The social dynamics of that room must have been really, really interesting. I'm kind of thinking Oliver Stone was probably pretty vocal and had the gravity to sort of control the room. But I don't know for sure. I mean, like...
Oh, yeah, it's just a fun exercise, you know, to guess.
It's a really good question.
Well, it'd be a really cool kind of short film.
It does have a One Night in Miami kind of feel to it, right? Can't we make up some sort of movie version of what this would have been like?
Does The Wrap have a production house that we could?
Not yet, but you know, hey, things are moving and shaking around here. Listen, but this is the part of what I thought was really interesting about your uncovering this, Ben, is it does kind of remind all of us of sort of the pre-9/11 and post-9/11 world in terms of storytelling. And one of the things I think that is worth pointing out is that we didn't ever imagine anything so shocking as planes, suicide, you know, politically motivated terrorists flying a plane into a building or flying into the Congressional, the Capitol, or the Pentagon, which is... It sort of beggars the imagination in a way. And it's interesting to think about how that has impacted storytelling as we've moved into this period?
Well, the big change to me seems to be in action and tentpole types of movies is if you look before 9/11, all the superhero movies took place in sort of pretend worlds. You know, they weren't real worlds. Joel Schumacher's Batman did not exist in a real universe. But after 9/11, pretty much all of these movies started to get really grounded in reality. The Dark Knight even sort of dealt with some of, the excesses of the intelligence community and wiretapping and all that stuff that was so such a hot button issue at that point. And all the superhero movies, they took place in reality. They got darker. So I think that may be one of the realities of it. But I don't know. I'm sure there are many dissertations that have been written about this.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it pushed us into a more areas of shock of like it wasn't sufficient just to blow up a building or to blow up a car, that it pushed creative people. They had to come up with more horrific and outrageous things because the things that we were seeing, the whole Game of Thrones series feels to me like a post 9/11 creation in the level of violence and the level of sort of nonstop rage or it's not even hostility. It's just violence, you know, as beautiful as it is, as intricate as the storytelling is. And I know the story predates 9/11, but the execution of it on, as a series.
What's interesting to me is that Hollywood is sort of the opposite of a first responder. It takes so long for something that happens in reality in the culture to bubble up into a movie. So it's like a good 2, 3, 4 years before you start seeing the effects of 9/11 on entertainment. And I suspect the same thing will be true of COVID. In 3 or 4 years, we'll start seeing what impact that had on national storytelling.
Yeah. Well, I think it occurs to me that academics and, properly trained critics would probably have a more refined point of view about this. But I really appreciate, Ben, you're sort of delving in, like remembering this nugget and delving into what was really kind of an extraordinary collaboration between a government that was, as you point out, really not inclined to embrace Hollywood at all, particularly after the Clinton years when there was like a very severe reaction and like a conscious effort to distance themselves, the Bush administration, from Hollywood to lean in a way like this is really fascinating.
Yeah, it was a really interesting little snippet of post 9/11 history.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for digging it out and telling. You can read Ben's story on The Wrap, and we look forward to the other things that you're working on, which are all really interesting as well. Thanks, Ben.
On Monday, we learned the shocking news that Michael K. Williams, star of HBO's The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, and Lovecraft Country, passed away at the age of 54. The actor seemed to leave a legacy behind that was much greater than his level of stardom. Here to discuss is the Ringer's Van Lathan, who hosted a podcast all about The Wire, Way Down in the Hole. Thank you for joining us, Van.
No problem. Well, good to see you, old friend.
Good to see you. So I want to start there with the point that I raised. It does feel like Michael K. Williams' passing generated a response that outweighed his mainstream celebrity status. Why do you think that is?
Because there's a difference between importance and popularity. You know, I think there are a lot of actors out there, a lot of people out there who are popular because they do popular things. You know, you'd be popular if you're going to be in a big Marvel movie or a big tentpole four quadrant IP movie. And those things are great, and we need those things to certainly take our eyes and ears off of some of the horror that's going on in the world right now. But to be important to people, you have to make important art. And Michael K. Williams was in one of the most important shows in television history, and he played arguably the most important role in that show. And it's a role that touched people. It's a show that continues to get more fans every single year and continues to be more culturally relevant and important as time goes on.
So you said it, he is best associated with Omar from The Wire, but he was nominated for 5 Emmys, including this year for Lovecraft Country. Uh-huh. No nominations for The Wire. The Wire was historically left off of Emmy ballots every year. What is it about that character, do you think, that has stuck with people for so long?
Purity. Omar's pure. Now, when I say pure, I don't mean that Omar's a good guy. Like, you know, Omar has a moral compass, but you know, Omar lives a life of violence. He lives a life of usury, takes advantage of people, takes advantage of the right people for us to care about as an audience, but still he takes advantage of people all the same. But in the world that Omar exists in, what you see is a sliding scale of morality. You see people doing their best to hold on to the little bit of humanity that they have before the lifestyle that they're involved in makes them completely change everything that they think that they know about themselves. That's not Omar Little. Omar Little was a hero in the show. He was confident. He was powerful. He was vulnerable. And he was a radical view of a stick-up kid, stick-up man in West Baltimore. And because of that, he ended up being the guy that you rooted for. Now, there was a lot of guys to root for in The Wire, right? Because there was always someone worse, right? You think Avon's bad? You haven't met Marlo yet, right? So there's always someone worse. But Omar loved purely. He gave his word purely. He loved his friends and his family purely. And he didn't put civilians in harm's way. And he wouldn't have done that. He wasn't someone who was wasteful. And it made him somebody that we could all root for.
After this, we're going to have an interview that I did with Ernest Owens, who wrote a piece for The Griot about what Omar meant to him as a gay Black man. What do you think Omar's sexuality did for the conversation about homosexuality in the Black community in general? Because I think it was never a defining characteristic of Omar, but it was always there, and they portrayed it, I thought, very honestly and very real. And I thought it did a lot for that discussion.
So I'm going to quote somebody that people wouldn't think that I would quote.
Kanye?
Yeah.
Lucky guess.
Kanye once said in an unbelievably brave interview with Sway on MTV that gay is the opposite of hip hop. That they would be sitting in a studio somewhere recording music and someone will say, oh, yeah, man, that's hip hop right there. That's hip hop. If they like it. And if they don't like it, they will say, oh, man, that's gay. And the gay, to call something gay or to identify something as gay for a long time and for a lot of places, in a lot of places, it still does, completely subtract it from anything that had any worth, right? It'd be like, oh man, you love this athlete? Bro, I heard he's gay. Damn, I used to like him. You know what I mean? It was a completely dehumanizing condition to have or a completely dehumanizing thing to be. Omar challenged that. The fact that you loved Omar Little from the first moment that you saw him in The Wire never changed. And they never compromised about his homosexuality. They showed Omar with men. Sexually, they show Omar loving men. They show Omar grieving over men. And it wasn't something to where it was like Omar was bouncing around from place to place, cruising and living up to any stereotype. He was a human being that fell in love with other men. And they never took their foot off the gas pedal with that. So they never were like, hey, you know, they get to a point to, oh, like Omar's doing it because he's in jail. No, if you love Omar, which almost everyone who watched The Wire did, I would say everyone who watched The Wire did, you love that aspect of them. And it forced you to confront, and this is very silly because we have people out there that are living real lives they don't get the same grace in society, right? But to a character on a television show, you can look at it and you can say, yo, man, I remember where my homeboys Ryan went, man. Omar, he a G, bro. It don't even seem like he, and I'm like, seem like he's what? So it forced a lot of guys, especially during this time the show was coming out, we were in our early 20s, to see him as something more than his sexuality. And the fact that they didn't dial that back or in any way give you anything that pulled him out of that, he was who he was. And it really meant a lot to a lot of people. It meant a lot to me.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, in movies, being straight is not the defining characteristic of any character. But in film and television, very often being gay is just the defining characteristic of that character. That's just all they are. And right. Everything else is secondary. And Omar was never that.
Right. Right. You know, and so it once again, but this is, it couldn't have been played by anybody other than Michael K. Williams, who portrayed the character with a fierce vulnerability that you rarely see on screen. But also, you got to give it up to Burns and Simon on that, and to all the great writers that made that amazing piece of television novelization known as The Wire. It was just perfect.
When you heard the news on Monday that he had passed, I don't know if you did the same thing I did, but I imagine so, which is you went to YouTube and you probably found an Omar clip to sort of take in. Which one did you choose?
So the clip of Omar that I actually watched, and I didn't watch it right away. I was so floored and leveled. I was so floored and leveled by the moment. I had gotten to know him a little bit in the last couple of years, just through text and DM. Like, he hit me up last year to help get the word out about an initiative he was doing in Brooklyn. So I just looked at it, and for a second I was just like, I can't believe this. I said this on my podcast, and I'll say it again. Whatever God is trying to convince us of in these last couple of years, I surely hope that we're all listening, because I've had this same feeling last year, and it was Chadwick Boseman's name that was in the headlines. It's just nuts. But the scene that I watch, and it's a sneaky good one, is when Omar walks in on Prop Joe, and he comes into the clock shop, or the handyman appliance shop, whatever it is that Prop
with Joe's his clock to fix.
His clock to fix. It's shit everywhere. And I like it because when you talk about having a three-dimensional character, of course there's vulnerability, of course there's grief, of course there's all those things, but there's also a little bit of arrogance, some toughness. Like, Omar knew who he was and he liked who he was, right? So to see him be there and see him be in his swagger, to see him talk tough, talk around threats to the point that they actually are scarier, that was some of the best acting that I had seen Michael K. do. Because, you know, he's talking to one of the biggest drug dealers in East Baltimore, and he's pulling his car with every single sentence. So I just love that scene, and I always love that scene. I love Omar when he's, you know, being Omar, being smart, being vulnerable, being fierce, whatever. But I also just love Omar when he's enjoying being Omar. It's a fun character.
Yeah, I went stereotypical and I watched the scene with Bunk on the park bench, which is a classic. And I don't think I'd fully noticed that he plays that scene 99% like tough and strong and telling Bunk, you know, stay away. And as soon as Bunk leaves, you can see the tears in his eyes.
Right.
It's welled up because he's thinking about his friend who was killed, and he knows he's kind of doing the wrong thing. And
yeah,
he just turned in a second, and it just showed you the depth of what he was able to do. I want to ask you one last thing.
Sure.
You talked about your reaction to the news. I don't know if you saw this. Clark Peters, who played Lester Freeman on The Wire, tweeted, I think it was that day, and I thought it was very honest, and it's the kind of thing that people don't say. It's the kind of thing they think, maybe, but don't ever say. And this was his tweet. He wrote, quote, "I'm conflicted over Michael K. Williams' death. Pissed off that he let us down. Angry he could have reached out and didn't. Instead, led us to believe he was all right. Sorry that another brother's life has been wasted. We can do better than this. Talk to a brother. R.I.P. How do you feel about that?
Because
I think that's the reaction a lot of us have at first, like, oh, why? And, but you don't, it's very rare to hear people articulate that thought.
So I was in the car with my dad one time, a long time ago. I lost my father earlier this year. But this is one memory that sticks out. I was in the car with my dad, and my dad was on the phone with my uncle. My uncle's now passed away as well. My uncle had struggled with addiction his entire adult life, been in and out of jail. And I remember the look on my father's face as he hung up the phone and realized that for whatever reason, that my uncle was back on drugs. And I realized how defeated he sounded, and how my father, who was not a very emotional man, I think I can count on my hand how many times I saw him cry, and the number was one. He was balled up. There was nothing he could do. Okay. And I remember this was driven home even more to the point who caught the brunt of that. I did. He turned around at me, looked at me, said, "Lo, just let you know, if I ever catch you fucking with drugs, I'll kill you." You know? He had seen too much of it. It had been too much of a grip on people around us. And so I think I say all that to say that addiction has a funny way of victimizing more people than just the person that's going through it. And because Clark had a close relationship with Michael K. Williams, because they had worked together, I can understand him feeling let down or upset or angry. I will say, though, that oftentimes when we personalize something like that, we're not making space for the people that were going through the hell. Michael K. Williams didn't want to die of a heroin overdose. Were there things that he probably could have done to not have had that happen? Sure. Absolutely. People get off of drugs. It happens. But to be angry at him for something that for a lot of people it takes a Herculean effort to control, I think is wrong-headed. And I say this with all love and respect to the legend Clark Peters. I think it's wrong-headed to be angry with people because you're sad that they couldn't have done better. Being sad that somebody couldn't have done better is one thing, but being angry at them because they didn't fix themselves, it errs toward belittling what it was that they were going through. And so I'm not trying to accuse Clark Peters of that. He's processing, as are we all. Yeah. But we have to remember these problems, you know, they aren't anthills, they're mountains. And you don't really know how hard they are to move until you're standing in front of one.
I know it's tough. It's hard to judge anyone's emotions in a moment like that. And thank you for sharing that story about your dad. And thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time. No. What'd I do?
Nothing. I'm saying whenever I like to do something to fuck with people that are when I'm a guest on the podcast, whenever they say, "Hey, it's time to get off the podcast," I then react. I exclaim something. I go, "Whoa, hey!"
I'm trying to let you go. You're a busy guy.
No, I'm saying, like, you know, I'm saying, get it out there. And look, it worked on Daniel. I've known Daniel for so long, you guys.
I know. Yes, I should have probably said that off the top. We've been friends for 12,
something like that. Yeah,
a long time.
You're not aging. You still look like Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius, the only white man in the world that's aging well. You and Tom Cruise, two whites. Everybody
I never go out in the sun. I stay indoors as much as I can, and I think it's helped me a great deal. Yes, indeed. But yes, thank you for joining us, Van. I appreciate your time. Glad we were able to pull this off.
No problem. Anytime, man.
All right, now we're going to bring in Ernest Owens, a man of many titles, right? I saw your editor-at-large at Philly Mag, the president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. And you wrote a column for The Griot that I'm really excited to talk to you about. Thank you for joining us here today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me on.
So the headline of your piece was Michael K. Williams' legacy of playing queer characters was powerfully underrated. I think it's such an interesting part of of his legacy, because he did play so many different ones, Omar from The Wire being the most prevalent. What did Omar mean to you?
I mean, I think for Omar, for context, you know, I'm a millennial. I'll be 30 in October. So by the time The Wire came out, I was definitely around like 11 to 12 years old. And, you know, I knew I was gay, and I didn't see really good representations of queer people on TV that were Black, especially Black men. Growing up, I remember seeing clips of Living Color with the Hated It and all of these types of stereotypes. And then I look at a show like The Wire and I see this guy who's like, just, you know, he's definitely not me, but he was this tough and confident and sexual and respected and feared. And he had all of these different character traits that just were normalized in this show. And what really stuck out to me the most about Omar was that, although he was confident in who he was and his sexuality, it did not dictate his character. I felt like all of the movies and shows I watched at that time, which was like what, the early 2000s, it's like if they had a gay character, that's all they talked about. We didn't know about their life or what other aspects of who they were. They were very stereotyped. They were either a political statement about LGBTQ issues, or they were just some comic relief. And Omar just had more depth and nuance. And, you know, over the years, you know, as I got older, you know, I went back to review the show and watch it with a level of maturity and as an adult, and realized that, you know, Michael K. Williams was actually straight. He was a cishet man. And I was like, wow, you know, this man has lots of talent. And then have instantly, you know, followed his career, watched several of his movies, a lot of stuff that he did with HBO. And he was never afraid to take on these queer characters, even as his career expanded. Because, you know, The Wire was a breakthrough for his acting and for his career. And for some people, you know, that's like that one role you do and then you don't got to do it again. But he just kept doing it and it felt real. And he just loved the versatility of his acting in the same way that we saw Sean Penn do Milk. He, you know, portrayed Harvey Milk and won the Oscar. You know, we would see Kenneth, you know, go off to do other performances where he would get Emmy nominations. So, you know, just seeing him pass, you know, recently like this, I just think of, as a queer person who's loved entertainment, that he was so unique in that way, that he was one of the few successful Black actors that took on queer parts, that was able to maintain his bravado and his and all of his nuance, and wasn't afraid to be an actor that would do death. Because so many other actors in the industry, as you know, that are Black, oftentimes are stigmatized for doing roles like that. Will Smith, Samuel Jackson, Kevin Hart, the list goes on. And I thought it was very bold to make sure that people knew that Kenneth Williams was just a great person, ally, and actor.
Did you ever see the movie Chasing Amy?
Yes.
So there's a character in that movie, if you remember, a gay Black male who explains that he sort of talks about how gay Black men are represented in films in a certain way all the time. And that it's sort of like a subgenre within a genre. And it just is very hard for the representation to feel accurate. And I think you make a really good point that Omar was a character who also happened to be gay. He was not a gay character.
Correct.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Hooper Lamonte, I think his name was the character.
I love that movie. I've seen it.
And again, it was just, what he did with that character continued to prove that point. I think Hollywood gets it. But, you know, even with Kenneth's characters, he continued to keep that message alive. Even when his latest character, Montrose, which he received an Emmy nomination for, many people think he's going to get it. I hope he does. He'll be the 7th actor to posthumously win an Emmy for a role, which would be historic. And it would be interesting to see it. But, I mean, with even Montrose has so much nuance and depth. And we see this in other characters that he's played over the years. Besides just Montrose, he's done other, you know, characters that, you know, carried that mantle. Biopics, he portrayed an activist in a recent film that came out not too long ago, a couple years ago, and When We Rise, and he played a gay black veteran in Leonard and Hap.
Leonard, yeah.
He's done all of that. And, you know, those weren't the more buzzier, high profile, but it speaks to his consistency with those type of roles, in addition to playing other great cishet characters and like When They See Us and whatnot.
Do you think the legacy of Omar would have been different if he'd been played by a gay actor?
Absolutely. I think the role itself, just the character, was powerful and very bold. And so whomever would have played it would have given it a unique thing. I think that it's one of those roles that are that I think of like, you know, Mama June and Gypsy, like Ethel and Bernadette Peters played. Everybody wants to play that role. Everybody wants to be, you know, Julius Caesar. Everybody wants to be, you know, that. I feel like Omar is a character, a role that so many people probably in retrospect wish they would have done because of how much it was wonderful. But I think, you know, Michael K. Williams took a character that wasn't even supposed to last all those seasons. It wasn't even supposed to be 5 seasons. But because he was so damn good at the role, he made it stretch and made it become more. So I would say that I think it would have been a different conversation, for sure. But I think what he did with the role transformed it to more than just a conversation. I think if a gay actor would have played the role, we would have been more fixated on the convincibility of him being a gangster. Could he been able to transition? Could he been able to, you know, transition that character? You know, we would have spent more time talking at that time about the actor playing the role than the role itself. And that was just where we were in society. So I think that because Michael K. Williams was a cishet actor playing the character, we spent more time talking about Omar than Michael K. Williams and who they are. And that's just thinking about the historical context of how we talk about celebrity and actors and how we even treated openly gay actors at the time. I mean, think about Ellen DeGeneres when Ellen was, you know, coming out. We spent more time talking about Ellen than we did the roles, which is why you think of actresses like Rosie O'Donnell, who, when they came out later in their career, they did less roles, but she was in the Flintstones as a, in what we thought was a cishet actress at the time. So I think it would have been a very different conversation. It still would have been a buzzy role, but I think we would have been focused more on the actor than the role itself.
Yeah, I agree. And I think to your earlier point, it just, it goes to his performance and the way the character was written, that being gay was just part of him. It didn't define him. It's not one of the first things you would say about him, when most of the roles at that time, if there was a gay man in the role, that was probably the first thing you said, right? They were just, there was a token aspect to it on a lot of levels. And I think he really obliterated that idea completely in that performance.
Oh, totally.
Ernest, thank you so much. I appreciate you giving your perspective on this. Like I said, I'm just devastated. The Wire. I mean, Michael K. Williams meant a lot to me and that part and that role. And so I'm glad you were able to share your perspective. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I just hope people just, you know, go on HBO Max. There's a lot. I just have been watching some of those previous specials and movies he's done for them. And, you know, I just think we should just, the work lives on.
For sure. And to our listeners, if you get a chance, Ernest's piece is on thegrio.com. It was published the day after Williams' passing. I highly recommend that everyone go read it. Thank you again, Ernest. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And if you're in the industry or wannabe, don't forget to sign up for our upcoming business conference, The Grill, where entertainment and technology meet. Speakers including Netflix's head of global film, Scott Stuber, the deal makers behind that Reese Witherspoon $900 million Hello Sunshine deal, streaming executives, producers, and innovators in technology. Join the event by signing up for Wrap Pro, our members-only offering from The Wrap, and an essential news source for the entertainment business. To attend The Grill and subscribe to Wrap Pro now, visit thewrap.com/the-grill-2021.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners, and remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.